This is the Down East Journal on Public Radio East. When most people think of drones, they think of military intelligence and surveillance. But unmanned aircraft can also be used in a variety of civil applications. North Carolina officials directed State Chief Information Officer Chris Estes and the Department of Transportation to determine if there's a need for drone technology in state and local government, and if so, begin planning for it. Estes says the 26-page document released last month concluded that governments in the state should pursue the use of drone technology.
It has literally hundreds of different uses. It's evolving, and we're anxious to see how it evolves.
Future uses for unmanned aerial vehicles, or UAVs, may prove useful for law enforcement in helping with surveillance, crowd control, and finding escaped inmates. Drones could also be used to monitor wildlife and for agricultural purposes. But right now, that's unauthorized. The Federal Aviation Administration has restricted the use of commercial drones until late 2015. This year's state budget mandated that any UAV flights conducted by government entities must be approved by CIO Estes.
Three locations in North Carolina where they've been issued the COA, and we've agreed and given them permission to fly in those three locations.
Land in Hyde County, and Buntner, and Moyock are the only areas that are approved for Next Gen Air Transportation Center at North Carolina State University to fly UAVs over. The nonprofit is leading the way in drone research by exploring the use of commercial drones in agricultural purposes.
We had a group looking at use in crop surveying, so farmers can survey crops with various types of instruments on the technology that would allow them to look at which areas of their field are stressed, which are in drought situations using infrared technology, where they might need to apply more water to increase the yield of their crop.
Drones could add an estimated $23.5 million to the agricultural sector between 2015 and 2017. According to statistics from the Association for Unmanned Vehicle Systems International, located in Arlington, Virginia, an estimated 80% of the commercial market for drones will be for agricultural uses. Eastern North Carolina is an area prone to hurricanes and severe weather. Another practical use for drone technology is hurricane and disaster recovery and in emergency situations.
It's an easy technology to deploy, so getting eyes on the scene in the event of a disaster is always a priority, and so you understand exactly what's going on. So there's numerous applications in an emergency situation, whether it be following something like a hurricane or lost child in the woods. I mean, there are multiple emergency management applications for the technology.
Perhaps the biggest advantage that drones offer is that they eliminate the need for a human pilot on board. Estes says this makes UAVs especially useful for fighting wildfires.
It's a lot safer to put this technology in the air over a fire. If it's damaged, it's definitely a loss, but it's not the same as a loss of a manned pilot who might be put in harm's way trying to look at the perimeters of a fire to understand where it is and which way it's moving.
Drones have already proven their flexibility. Recently, Wake Forest biology professor Miles Silman and a team of researchers used a fixed-wing drone to create a 3D model of the area impacted by a recent Duke Energy coal ash spill. ScienceDaily.com reported the UAV collected a mosaic of 282 images that led researchers to estimate how many millions of gallons of ash sludge spilled into the Dan River in February. Wake Forest is also using drones abroad to explore climate change in the Peruvian Amazon. While UAVs have a variety of uses, Estes says the main benefit to local and state governments is that drones are much less expensive to operate than traditional aircraft.
It's actually a very affordable technology. There's some units that are $400 to $500 range that are more hobbyist oriented, but still can carry a small payload, take a photograph, video imagery. So that's relatively inexpensive for most folks. And then obviously they move up in price range from there into the thousands of dollars.
The future of drone use in North Carolina looks promising. But before commercial drones are seen darting over Carolina skies, there are privacy and data security issues that need to be addressed. Estes says the state is working closely with the Federal Aviation Administration to identify safety concerns.
Sharing the airspace with manned aircraft is one of the foremost concerns the FAA has with the technology is how do they coexist in the same airspace. For example, I had a North Carolina Highway Patrol trooper fly a helicopter, and they were concerned about the safety of the pilot in the air in case the pilot couldn't see this unmanned air system in the air. It might actually, crash into him while he's flying, and that wouldn't be good for anybody.
Non-commercial use of UAVs is allowed in North Carolina, but strict regulations apply. For example, drones can't be operated within 5 miles of an airport and must travel below 400 feet. Supporters of UAV technology are touting economic gain and job creation as reasons for commercial drone use in the state. According to a study by the Association for Unmanned Vehicle Systems International, UAVs are expected to contribute $153 million to North Carolina's overall economy between 2015 and 2017.
There are multiple states that have passed various laws on this particular technology. Most of them centered around, privacy and making sure that citizens' privacy is protected, which is definitely on the forefront of North Carolina's General Assembly's mind. There's a special committee from the General Assembly that's been studying this topic, and ultimately they will make the policy decisions that's in line with the will of the people.
The Legislative Research Committee meets later this month to finalize their report. It's not known at this time if the topic will be addressed during the General Assembly's short session in May or the long session next year. A new novel by a Raleigh author and one-time Jacksonville newspaper reporter introduces a new character investigating murderous ongoings at her old stomping ground. George Olson has more.
In 1993, N.P. Simpson published a book about a 1981 triple homicide at Camp Lejeune that to this day is unresolved.
Now, the perception was that the person who did it just got off on a technicality, but that's not true. That's not the case at all. But at the same time, I think that gives it an unsatisfying edge. I can't supply another ending to this because this is real life. Real life is a continuum.
Simpson says that was a problem with her book, Tunnel Vision. Readers don't want to feel that a murderer somehow escaped punishment or was rewarded. And that's why she believes fictional murder mysteries are so popular with the reading public.
In these murder mysteries, you're dealing with very profound events. I mean, the greatest event that can happen would be the loss of a life. But it's nobody you're related to, and it's nobody you know. They're fictional characters, and I think that allows you to confront this, but at the same time to distance yourself from it. In the same way, I don't want to be a homicide detective. I'm glad we have them, but frankly, I don't think I could deal with it. But at the same time, to read about it and take just a little bit of their life is rewarding, and it's exciting.
Thus, N.P. Simpson, 20 years after her first nonfiction book publication, takes on the world of a fictional investigator and the first of what she hopes will be a series starring Naval Criminal Investigative Service agent Fran Setliff. Her first Fran Setliff novel is entitled B.O.Q. and is set at Camp Lejeune, an area she is familiar with as a then-wife to a Marine based at Lejeune and as a former reporter for the base's Globe newspaper and then for the Jacksonville Daily News. That familiarity is just part of the reason for basing the book at Camp Lejeune.
It's an interesting cast of characters, and let me put three quick things that are unique about a military community. First thing, everybody who lives there is young. Second thing, everybody who lives there is fit. It is unusual to see an obese person on a Marine Corps base. Fitness is their mania. Fitness is part of their job description. They're actually tested on it. That's different than what you see in the civilian world. And the third thing is, everybody that you see there has a sense of purpose, has a job that has a good opportunity for promotion. Every kid in the school has at least one parent who's employed in a job that has an opportunity for promotion. I mean, that's not true of many communities. That's almost, it sounds like, Stepford Wives, it sounds so. I mean, there are definitely difficulties. I'm not playing down that there are negatives that you have to accept, but at the same time, it's unique. It has a vibe that's different because of it.
But the uniqueness of military life gave Simpson pause about how relatable a book involving military culture would be, given a growing gap between civilians and the military as the percentage of Americans who served dwindles. Her concern was those unfamiliar with the military might have a hard time identifying with its culture.
Then I tell myself, you're worried about Camp Lejeune, and here are people buying, Star Trek books. Talk about a really, really different environment.
Hence, she went ahead and set the book on Lejeune post-Gulf War, but pre-9/11. Simpson says she didn't want to get into the issue of terrorism. But nevertheless, she does bring up issues that were common to the military of 20 years ago as well as today, such as issues surrounding the integration of women into the military.
One of the, you might say, the suspects involved in this was a woman Marine officer. And I think she makes it clear that juggling is the same, whether it's a woman Marine or whether it is a, you know, a Home Depot executive of the home and your professional career, and maybe more demanding in the military because you aren't just gone for the weekend. You may be gone for a whole year at a time. There's that, a woman being able to maintain her personal integrity and yet still be able to assert herself, play a kind of game when the rules are sort of built in, and she's having to bend them a little, but at the same time, she doesn't want to bend them so much that she damages the organization.
But while BOQ touches on contemporary themes, at its heart, it's an old-fashioned closed-circle mystery. There's a body in the room, or in this case, under a dock, and a limited circle of people who might be just as happy the victim is dead rather than alive. And N.P. Simpson is fine with that. While any modern murder mystery might initially draw comparisons to contemporary fictional crime solvers like Kay Scarpetta or Alex Delaware, Simpson doesn't particularly want that association.
I don't much care for the grisly gore type novel that has been popular recently because I don't have to read six pages, you know, of a cell layer by cell layer description of a rape to grasp, you know, the seriousness of the event. There's something about it I just don't care for. I'm a Conan Doyle fanatic. I'm a Sherlock Holmes admirer. It's the step-by-step process of what's going on here and what is the conclusion is what's important to me. I'm really not interested in how much of a psychopath the killer was.
Simpson says she already has two more books featuring Fran Setliff in mind, the next to take place not on board Camp Lejeune but at Guantanamo Bay in the early 1990s. The gap between publishing BOQ and the next, probably not as long as the 20-year gap between nonfiction book number one and fiction book number one, though Simpson says she probably rewrote BOQ at least six times before it was ready to go. And the killer in version one wasn't the same as the killer who made the printed page. That might seem a little odd, but she says in this closed-circle type of mystery, everybody and anybody should make sense for the book to satisfy its reader.
I think I did try, and let's say there are six red herrings, or six different people who might be plausible suspects. I think I had to write it in my mind as though each one were the actual perpetrator, because for it to be credible to the reader, it would have to be credible to me. In other words, it couldn't be purely a red herring where I can remember, and actually I'm not sure Agatha Christie actually said this, but I think I read somewhere that she said a really good mystery, you should be able to go back to the beginning of the book and reread it and see early signs that this is the way it really happened. There should be clues from the very beginning. And if you don't see any clues until the last quarter of the book, then you're sort of jerking, well, of course, Agatha Christie didn't use the expression jerking around, but you're sort of playing with your reader.
N.P. Simpson is the author of BOQ, an NCIS Special Agent Fran Setliff novel. It's published by John F. Blair. I'm George Olson.
The Downeast Journal is made possible by our Public Radio East members in partnership with Eastern Dermatology and Pathology PA, Greenville. Dermatologist providing dermatologic skin care, including silk peel dermal infusion, laser hair removal, Botox, dermal fillers, and cosmetics. Online at easternderm.com.
Public Radio East is celebrating its 30th anniversary by helping to restore the striped bass population in eastern North Carolina. Each pledge made during our recent pledge drive meant 100 striped bass would be nurtured and then later released to our local rivers by the NC Wildlife Resources Commission. More than 500 people pledged during our membership drive, meaning that more than 50,000 striped bass will be finding their way to the Neuse and Tarpamaco rivers later this year. The striped bass is a valuable natural and economic resource to NC coastal rivers. More stripers mean healthier fisheries and more opportunities for anglers. Thank you, Public Radio East members, for helping replenish this natural resource.
28 counties across the state don't have a psychiatrist, leaving many to seek treatment in local hospital emergency rooms. But the statewide telepsychiatry program, which started in January, is designed to address a shortage of psychologists, especially in rural areas. The program is helping patients get the help they need by using video and audio streaming video conferencing technology similar to Skype or FaceTime. East Carolina University's eBehavioral Health Telepsychiatry Center is providing the consultations, and so far, the program is showing positive results. A recent study from the North Carolina Center for Public Policy Research found that patients who receive telepsychiatry consultations are spending less time waiting in emergency rooms and have a lower likelihood of returning for treatment. This week, I spoke with Deputy Secretary for Health Services and Acting State Health Director, Dr. Robin Cummings, about the telepsychiatry program rollout and how the technology works.
Telepsychiatry is using technology to connect a resource to areas where that resource is very scarce. In this case, we're talking about psychiatry and patients and individuals who have behavioral health issues and challenges, and they need psychiatric attention or assistance. And so telepsychiatry is the use of two-way, real-time audio and video IT equipment that you're connecting a psychiatrist in one location to a patient in another location.
The purpose of the statewide telepsychiatry program is to improve patient access to psychiatrists and behavioral health care providers, and the target area of the program is mainly rural areas. Why is that?
We're going to bring telepsychiatry to our emergency rooms across North Carolina. This came to our attention some time back when hospital administrators were telling us that they were having difficulty with providing good psychiatric consultation to their emergency room patients. Patients would literally come into the emergency room and sometimes would sit for hours, sometimes days. And in one case, I had a hospital administrator tell me he kept one patient for up to 30 days, waiting for a disposition. And the problem is that, like any illness, patients who come in with a behavioral health challenge need the attention of a doctor. In this case, they need the attention of a psychiatrist. And again, those can be psychiatrists can be sometimes difficult to find simply because of the scarcity. So the goal of the statewide telepsychiatry program was to facilitate that kind of patient interaction by using technology to bring psychiatrists to every emergency room in North Carolina.
The way the telepsychiatry program works is that a psychiatrist who can literally be hundreds of miles away uses a high-definition monitor screen and cameras to see the patient. Now, how does this technology compare with an actual in-person visit?
This equipment is so specialized that the doctor sitting where he or she is can actually focus down on the patient. They can focus down on the pupils, for example, and see if the pupils are dilating or constricting. They can look at actually identify hairs on the patient and see if the hairs are showing signs that maybe the patient might be agitated or upset, might see sweating on the skin, for example. In some ways, the exam is probably more up close and personal in some ways than sitting there in a room talking to the patient. So bottom line is, yes, it's very well accepted, and all the studies would indicate that it is just as effective.
The statewide telepsychiatry program started back in January. What exactly did the rollout look like across the state and here in eastern North Carolina?
Well, it started in eastern North Carolina at East Carolina, and originally the original pilot program was in eastern North Carolina through the Albemarle Hospital Foundation. So it started there, and the rollout really has been like bringing water to the desert. I mean, people need this so badly. Hospital administrators were literally calling us to say, can I get on a waiting list? When are you guys going to start? How are you going to start? And so forth. So we are just finishing our first quarter, and we've already signed up 64 or so hospitals. And our goal for the entire 2 years of the project was only 60 hospitals. And I would dare say that within the first, we had already a waiting list that encompass that entire number of hospitals that we needed. So we've sort of had to cut it off at this point. And so now what we're doing is going to each of those hospitals, depending on their order of signing up and some other factors, and bringing telepsychiatry to each of those emergency rooms.
Do you think that this type of interaction yields the same results as an in-person visit?
Studies would indicate that telepsychiatry is as effective as the face-to-face interaction. And it's especially effective in kids. Children are so accustomed to dealing with TV and with the monitors and with technology, they literally just take to it without hesitation.
Now, the program has been going on for about 4 months now. Are there more patients being seen across the state because of the telepsychiatry program?
Jared, no question. We finished our first quarter, and so those numbers should be ready in the next few weeks. We'll be looking at the total number of patients that we see. We want to look at the number of patients who end up either being admitted to the hospital or importantly, not admitted to the hospital because a good disposition was made by a board-certified, qualified psychiatrist. We'll be looking at the opportunity that we've had through this program to tie those patients who we're seeing in the emergency room with the surrounding physicians and capabilities of the community to help take care of them so they don't go home and get in trouble and come back to the emergency room. So we've got probably a dozen or so quality metrics that we will be measuring that will tell us if we are being successful. So we just finished our first quarter, and we're excited about seeing those first quarter results.
What do you expect to be happening over the next 6 months?
We are rolling it out, rolling the program out as our resources allow us. Obviously, you can't start everyone at once. So we've got 25 or so hospitals that are fully with instrumentation. They're up and running. Everything is good. And so we'll be bringing on another two or three, four hospitals in the coming weeks and then continue that for the two-year project until we completely fill up those 64 hospitals that have signed up.
Dr. Cummings, thank you so much for speaking with us. Really appreciate it.
Jared, thank you, and appreciate the opportunity to spread the good news.
This is Ann Edwards, Horticulture Extension Agent, with this week's entry in the Garden Journal. The carpenter bees and the paper wasps have arrived, or I guess I should say have awakened. You've probably started seeing overwintering paper wasp queens becoming active and looking for nest sites. Most of these queens have passed the winter inside walls, attics, and crawl spaces, so you may find them like I did on a kitchen window or inside the screen porch. This doesn't mean that they have a nest there. This is just where they crawled out after their long winter. These wasps are moving slowly right now, unless you have a warm day, and then they start to really buzz around. Because they're moving slowly, these early emerging queens can easily be killed with a rolled-up newspaper or magazine. This is probably safer, particularly inside your house, than unloading a can of insecticide on them. So what are these queens doing? They're looking for a place to build a nest. And the good news is, early in the season when the nests are just getting started, there will be very few workers, which minimizes the risk of getting stung when dealing with the nest. That being said, don't approach a paper wasp nest with a rolled-up newspaper. If you find a nest, that's the good time to get the aerosol foams that you can spray 15 to 20 feet, and from a safe distance, soak the nest when the workers are at home. After the workers are killed, you can then knock the nest down with a broom or something similar. However, I should remind you that paper wasps are beneficial insects. They eat caterpillars and other insects that might otherwise be eating your flower or vegetable garden. That being said, I understand when there's a paper wasp, and they can be aggressive and they do sting, right next to your door or right next to your children's swimming pool, well, it's something you need to take care of. However, if the nest is way up high, say on the side of your chimney, wasps do tend to look for tall spaces. You certainly don't want to endanger yourself by climbing up on a ladder just to take care of the nest. An early spring pressure washing of the house might be a good time to take care of these taller, small nests. But again, take precautions. Paper wasps aren't the only insects buzzing around right now. The carpenter bees are here. These are goofy black and white bees that buzz right up to your face and that drill those annoying holes in wood. It looks like someone's taken a half-inch drill bit and drilled all over the side of your shed. Carpenter bees look like bumblebees, but don't have yellow hairs on their abdomen. You can actually identify the male carpenter bee when they're hovering in front of your face because they have a white-colored spot in the middle of their face. These male carpenter bees are harmless. They don't have stingers. And they also don't drill holes in your house. But they're out looking for the female bee to start new spring bees. I know you want me to tell you something simple and perfect to control carpenter bees and keep those holes off your building, but it just doesn't exist. Fill existing holes when you find them because they are often reused, and keep a fly swatter nearby. Keep watching for all the critters that are emerging here in the spring, and I'll talk to you in next week's entry in the Garden Journal.